Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WVUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When David Petit, an ordained Unitarian minister, decided to delve into his New England family's past, he got more information than he bargained for about his slave-owning and slave-trading forebears, about the long-obscured slave trade of the northern United States. And slowly, his quest took him to Queens, New York, and the family of Patricia Mann, a descendant of his family's slaves. This hour, On Point, we'll talk with Patricia Mann and David Petit about their shared past rooted in the northern slave trade. Patricia Mann is on her way to a studio in New York, but right now joining me in the studio here in Boston is Reverend David Petit. He's the Director of Ministerial Credentialing at the Unitarian Universalist Association in Boston, and he is, he recently learned, the Seven Greats grandson of Edward Simmons, slave owner. David Petit, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
So you say right off the bat, you were always interested in family history, but you started scratching around here, and before you know it, you're sharing with us tales of, a torched Pequot Indian fort all the way back in 1637, 600 people burned to death, put to the torch by your ancestor, John Mason. It sends a ship off to Bermuda, the survivors of the Mystic Massacre. That ship, the Desire, arrives back in Massachusetts in 1638. The governor at the time, Winthrop, notes the cargo includes salt, cotton, tobacco, and Negroes. And before we know it, it's not just a fort that your guy helped burn down that's setting off a trade, but your family itself bringing in slaves from that trade, involved in that trade. How did this fall into your life, your lap?
Well, I grew up in Massachusetts and inherited from my grandfather a well-developed sense of family genealogy. And it became a passion for me as it had been a passion for him. And over the last 30 years, it became a critical and important hobby for me. And over the years, I became better and better at sort of researching my family history. I had only heard stories about the good things that my ancestors had done. I'm on both sides are people who were among the early colonists of New England. Mm-hmm. I heard what I think was sort of a mythic sense of these people and the great accomplishments that were part of their legacy.
Pilgrims and Puritans. But 30 years of interest, and not until the last, does this big chapter
That's
show
right.
itself.
This story regarding slavery and the slave trade was completely forgotten. There was no memory in the family history about this. And the only way that I found it was by accident. I had been a subscriber to Ancestry.com, which is an internet subscription, mm-hmm. where you purchase the capacity to look at different kinds of online records.
Lots of amateur and otherwise genealogists digging around there for their own family history, you among them.
Yes. And in February of 2006, I decided to upgrade my subscription and to get access to all the records that were available online. So I did that. And looking at the available census records, I noticed that there was a census taken in Rhode Island in 1774. And so I thought to myself, well, let's see, who among my ancestors was living in Newport in 1774?
Yeah.
And Edward Simmons' name popped up. So mm-hmm. I punched his name in. And there on the census record were four black people living with him.
Did you understand immediately that they were black, African-American? Was it denoted in the census? And did it say slave? Or how did you figure out what that meant?
All it said was black. And what I realized I needed to do was to go down to Newport to the Historical Society to be able to look directly into the records themselves and see a transcribed copy of the census to be able to see what this actually meant, and learned by doing so that these four blacks were slaves, and two of them were boys under the age of 10.
Before this story was over, you had learned a lot about your family's involvement there, not just in owning slaves, but in trading slaves. But when you went into this, did you have any idea? I mean, we associate so deeply in this country the period of slavery with the South and plantations, but did you have any idea just how deeply New England was involved in slave trading and slave holding?
No, not at all. It just nothing was triggered for me to suggest that that this was part of a longstanding practice in New England. I had always imagined that slavery was a Southern institution, and it was the North with abolitionism that forced and helped end slavery in the 1860s.
So we'll go to the details of your family, but paint that picture for us. What was going on during this long period, decades in which your family was involved with slaves and this region of the North deeply involved with slaves? What's the context?
What I've come to understand is that certainly the economy of Massachusetts and much of New England was fueled by slavery and the slave trade. Narragansett Bay, with Newport and Bristol, Rhode Island particularly, was the heart of the colonial slave trade, and which means that many of the ships left from New England, they would travel over to Africa, often with rum as to be sold for enslaved Africans in Africa. And then the leg of the triangular trade went to the West Indies, where molasses was picked up. Molasses came north to New England, which was made into rum, sort of formulating the triangular trade.
So your ancestor, Edward Simmons, was a customer of this trade in that he must have somewhere along the line purchased these.
That's correct.
For slaves.
So I had discovered Edward Simmons. I began looking more deeply into other Newport ancestors, a generation before and a generation after him, found 15 other ancestors who were also slaveholders. And right in the middle of this collection of families was a man by the name of Captain John Robinson.
Before we even get to that, 15 ancestors all holding slaves. This wasn't a one-off rare thing. This I mean, when they got together, their slaves must have been one of the things they talked about.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
And depended on.
Yes.
And then you come to the father-in-law of one of these great greats, John Robinson.
That's right. The father-in-law of Edward Simmons, John mm-hmm. Robinson. I knew because the notion of being a captain before the Revolutionary War meant that he was a ship's captain. And I began looking for evidence of John Robinson and then discovered in the Newport Historical Society a slave ship manifest with John Robinson's name noted selling molasses to a distillery in Rhode Island.
The slave ship Greyhound was
yes,
the name.
That's right. And of note of the slave ship Greyhound, John Newton, who is the author of Amazing Grace, spoke of his conversion to Christianity in 1748 aboard a slave ship named Greyhound. And my ancestors' time as the captain of the Greyhound locally was in 1742, so it might well have been the same ship.
What a woven picture we end up with. I mean, he's composing Amazing Grace, and maybe at the other end of the deck, maybe,
yeah,
your forebear, John Robinson, captain of the slave ship, of course, taking slaves out of Ghana and the famous point of departure there. You eventually went to Africa yourself.
Yes.
Stood in those same chambers where you imagine almost certainly your forebear, John Robinson, stood making his deal for
yes,
human lives.
Yeah. By becoming familiar with the location that Rhode Island slave traders went to, it was often on the coast of Africa in Ghana, a couple of slave fortresses, in particular Cape Coast Castle and Elmina Castle, which are about 15 miles apart from one another. And these two fortresses still exist. They're World Heritage UNESCO sites of interest that are now places where people can come and tour and sort of see for themselves what these large bureaucratic structures were about. And my wife and I went to Africa February of last year to visit both these places. And the tour starts by going into the dungeons where the Africans themselves were held. Little tiny rooms, unventilated, incredibly hot, incredibly humid. And to sort of stand in a place and know that human beings had the capacity to do that to one another, even today, I have difficulty articulating how sad that experience was. And built directly above the dungeons is a room that's called the Palaver, which is the room where negotiations for lives took place. Mm-hmm. And the tour eventually made its way up to this room. And I remember at one point that I could look out the window of this building and see the exact same sight that John Robinson would have seen some 260 years before.
Early on in this process, you talked with an African-American friend, a historian, who said, David, don't just look at your own families in this. If you're going to do this, look at the lives of the Africans who your family was caught up with here. Look at their creative survival, I think was the phrase
yes,
that he used. You set out to do that and ended up on the telephone calling to New York City to, you know, almost out of the blue to a family who your family had once owned.
Right, right. It was out of the blue. The way that that story began was I noticed in the inventory of Edward Simmons' son a reference to a name of Cuff Simmons. The name Cuff is an African name, and Cuff is a variation of the name Kofi, which out of
as
the
in Kofi Annan maybe
yes out of the UN. Ghanaian Akan naming tradition where boys and girls are given particular names depending on what day of the week that they were born.
Mm-hmm.
So a child with the name of Kofi would have been born on a Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became very interested in who this fellow Cuff Simmons was. And it's kind of a long and complex story to tell you how I tied it all together. But it was looking at records that were not the primary source records people think of, you know, birth records, marriage and death. It was church records and all sorts of things that identified him as being owned by Edward Simmons.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about finding slaves in the family. Way north of the Mason-Dixon line, Reverend David Petit opened the books and found slaves and slave trading in the heart of his old New England family. At the urging of a friend, happened to be African-American historian friend, he reached out and found the family, the descendants of the family his family had, in the way of that time, owned. Patricia Mann is making her way by taxi right now when the subways let her down to a station in New York and will join us shortly. But let's go to Anne calling from Barrington, Rhode Island. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've called in before, as Tom might remember, talking about discovering that the stories my grandmother told me actually meant that we were African-American. I didn't quite understand how the stories went together till I was 55. And I missed a little when I called the call center, but I wanted to thank you so much for doing this because where I keep hitting dead ends is in places where we're on the slave schedule. And we may or may not be the people who are that mark under male, black, age 15 to 17. And the more that the slave-owning families can actually go to their own personal records and bring that stuff out into the public domain will actually help not only our total understanding of American history, but help those families whose ancestry research gets blocked, but whose families helped to build America.
I think this
is fantastic what you're doing.
And that in fact was kind of the case, and we'll hear it when we get Patricia, how she'd kind of lost the connection to the family history, wanted to know about it. And when David called, it ultimately let her know. But Anne, in your own case, so your presumption then is that you are descended from slaves, but you have not been able to track that back to who and where and the families that your forebears may have worked for.
My great-great-grandmother's sister is listed on the Freedmen's Savings and Trust Bank with the name of her owner. So I would love it if that family still existed and had some research. I've been unable to track it down. We can only kind of presume because of the lives that we led. We led, my grandparents and their families on both sides led African-American lives until 1910, at least in my direct line. But I think my grandmother's siblings and half-siblings, that their families still lead African-American lives.
Mm.
And I found a cousin, but we know we have other cousins that we just can't trace, and some just because they died before they had children. But we think that we can take things back to at least 1815, and we can surmise from the Virginia family names that indeed we were slaves within these planter households, and merchant households, actually.
Right.
So it's very hard, and any of the records that the merchants and planters and, you know, so traders and any of their records are just so valuable to people who were also here and helped build America, and I just think this is fantastic, And thank you very much.
And thank you very much, David Petit. There's a kind of thanks for reaching out from mm-hmm. someone who wishes maybe somebody would reach out and help illuminate her own family history there. But it must have been a moment of great apprehension when you actually braced to do that, to make a cold call to the descendant of people who'd worked as slaves for your family.
Right. I initially tried to make contact by sending a letter to Pat's mother and waited for a couple weeks for a response, got none, and then followed up with a phone call, hoping that the letter would lay the story out and we would have some grounding to begin, you know, what might have been a difficult conversation. Pat said, well, if my mother didn't recognize who wrote the letter, she would have thrown it away, so why are you calling? Hmm. And I just spit it out and said, your family and my family have a shared history that goes back into colonial Rhode Island. And have you ever heard of the name of Cuff Simmons? And she said, oh, yeah, I know a little bit about him. And I said Cuff Simmons was an early African who was owned by my family. And we began this conversation.
Long silence at that point or something else?
A bit of a silence. Mm-hmm. I couldn't hear because my own heart was beating so hard. And
I mean, after all, the 2 seconds before, she was just opening the day's mail or
right.
looking out the window or something. And then here you come 200 years of history back, boom, through the phone.
Yeah. And you know, she initially communicated a sense to me that she found this interesting and wanted to learn more. And I said, well, you know, I'd really like to have an opportunity to come meet you and share what I have learned.
You know, I wonder what you learned about what this relationship was like in the North in those years. Again, we have images of the South, of plantation life. You had a different economy in the North. Others, of course, have looked into this, famously connections between the family that founded Brown University mm-hmm. and the slave trade. There was a new memoir that came out not long ago from the DeWolf family. I think it was Thomas DeWolf called
right.
Inheriting the Trade.
Right.
Amazing stories there about family letters, one from July 4th, 1795, bought nine prime slaves. One woman and eight men paid for them tobacco, rum, hats, bread, mackerel. I mean, they were one of the largest slave trading families in the United States, as I understand, had plantations in Cuba, which were sort of way stations for their own trade. But in your family's case, four slaves on that record that first put you on this path.
Mm-hmm.
What do you know about what they did with your family?
Well, it's been difficult to get specific clarity around that. I think it's safe to say that in New England, enslaved Africans often lived in the households with their masters. There wasn't necessarily a separate safe slave quarters, mm-hmm. which certainly suggested a different kind of interaction between a master and an enslaved person.
Do you know what business Edward Simmons was in? Do you know what business or work they may have helped him with other than, let's say, domestic work, household work?
He was a merchant. He owned a lot of land. I'm not really clear exactly what his business was, but he was a considerable person in Newport prior to the Revolutionary War. I later came to learn that Cuff Simmons was a chimney sweep.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect
once he got his freedom or while he was.
Well, that's a good question, because I was looking for a specific record, a manumission statement that declared the end of his enslavement. I never found that.
Mm-hmm.
My sense is that in talking with historians that it was not uncommon for an enslaved African to be able to keep some of the money that was earned and over a period of time save that and then purchase their own freedom.
If, in fact, they were treated that well, your slave trading forebear, John Robinson, he was no stickler for the law, though,
no.
as you report, broke
right.
it in several different ways, including even once slavery was no longer permitted in the Northeast, he kept at it.
Well, actually, I think that—
Did I read you right?
Not quite. John Robinson died before the Revolutionary War. What I learned about John Robinson was through court records of mm-hmm. a woman whose minor child, I imagine 11 or 12-year-old boy, went on one of these slaving voyages, and then John Robinson refused to pay him for his services, and this child's mother took John Robinson to court, and there's a rather long and elaborate record of that particular situation.
So you've envisioned this from on the ground in Rhode Island and New England all the way to Ghana and the very building where many of these slaves were dispatched from. But you have a
clerical training, a background. Yeah. You also described this as a spiritual journey, a kind of spiritual root canal. I wish you'd share with us some of the spiritual or philosophical issues that have been brought to the fore by your investigation.
Well, I mean, part of my, you know, my training as a Unitarian Universalist minister is I really believe part of my task is to try to convert the difficult things that people have in their lives into some kind of meaning or truth. And in particular, one of the principles that was instructive for me was a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, where I would go as deeply into looking into the story as I possibly could without preconceptions and work with whatever I actually found. And to keep doing that, keep trying to find meaning. And, you know, what invariably comes with this particular kind of work is a lot of emotional discomfort. I mean, I certainly had moments of feeling intensely embarrassed and shameful and sad. And the way that I found to move away from the kind of paralysis that can set in when you have uncomfortable emotions was to begin to make contact with other people who were doing the same kind of discovery. And you mentioned Tom DeWolfe, Inheriting the Trade. That's a companion book to a film, Traces of the Trade, which is coming forth on Point of View on June 24th, which follows the DeWolfe family from Bristol to Ghana and also to Cuba, nine of these descendants trying to make sense of this
the same trade journey. As in slave trade.
Right. And I had a chance to get to know the film director and begin to make contact and build community with people who were doing this. And it was that sense of not feeling like I was alone, because for a long time I surely felt that I was, that began to give me the sense that part of the way through this was to share what I was learning, not censor it, and then begin to imagine how I could work toward making situations better and right some wrongs.
We are eager to hear how this looked from the other side of the equation. Patricia Mann, whose family worked for David Petit's family a couple centuries ago, as slaves in New England, making her way to a studio in New York right now, stuck in traffic, but we trust she'll get there. Let's take callers. We've got a lot of them who want to join us. David, Catherine is calling from Tarleton, Massachusetts. Catherine, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I'm so astonished to hear you all discussing this. My family is, we were all Southerners, and on both sides of my family we had slaves. But no, in history books, I've never heard this mentioned before, because we knew that the slaves mainly came in through northeastern shipping, because the South didn't have ships. They had plantations, and But slavery existed in the Northeast all along, only mostly in house slaves, not plant, because they didn't have plantations up here.
Right.
And I always thought it was sort of a holier-than-thou presentation in the history books that never mentioned any of this. And my family had given... slavery was dying out, because when the cotton gin came in, it became, fiscally improvident. But my family had given up slaves. My grandfather gave money and land to each of his slaves before the Civil War ever began. And when he went off to the war, the former slaves ran his plantation while he was away the 4 years in the war. He was from Texas.
Complex history, more complex history than we give credit for normally, Catherine.
Yes, and I think that it wasn't just blacks who were slaves in a way, too. You forget that in the North the factories were run by almost slaves. Children and indentured servants and things like that.
Yes, we know it well. My own family from that indentured servant line. Catherine, thank you very much for your call. David, Catherine's saying, in effect, you know, how do you think all those slaves got here? New England was the maritime center of the country. It had the shipping trade.
Right.
And whence, the slaves showed up. You've spoken yourself about the kind of regional amnesia that set in at a certain point in New England about its role in the trade and in slave owning.
Yeah. You know, I have a sense that as part of the creation of the mythology of the North as being morally superior and developing a kind of history that can be passed forward to make people feel good about the choices that they were made, that it began to lead toward a particular kind of forgetfulness and denial that slavery had ever taken place. It became quickly a Southern institution when clearly there was communities all across New England whom there were slaves in many households and particularly in some of the coastal communities.
Let's go to Hartman calling from Mashpee, Massachusetts. Hartman, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well. What do you know?
I'm calling, I guess, to throw some comments out there. I'm a Wampanoag of Mashpee down here, and one of the things that I've studied is the slave trade, not of the import of slaves, but of the export of slaves from this area.
So you're speaking as a descendant of Native Americans,
I'm speaking as a current Native American.
Yes, sir.
Native American.
Yes, sir.
I have not ceased to be. Our ancestors were shipped out, and between the 1630s and the 1780s, the Pequot War and King Philip's War, more Native slaves were exported from Connecticut than African slaves were imported into the Carolinas. So, you know, you've got comments that have talked about the it becoming a burden of the South, blame being put on the South, but also it's a scar oftentimes, seen as a scar of the African-American community, but it's also, had a deep effect on the Native American people by, helping to depopulate this area.
Yeah, Hartman, we began there, but incompletely, and I'm glad you take us back to it. Human bondage in many directions here in several different populations. David Petit, you sort of begin your story with that flame thrown back in 1637 at a Pequot fort, burning it down in Connecticut, I guess.
Yes.
And I think some Native American enslavement came straight out of that.
Yeah, the story, as I've understood it, was that the males, the men and the boys who survived the Mystic Massacre were loaded up on a ship, deemed to be too dangerous to have around, shipped to the West Indies. And they were sold along with some other goods for the purchase of Negroes that John Winthrop talks about. And that particular vessel arrived back in Massachusetts in 1638, which is the first clear record of slavery in New England.
And just a few decades later is where you find your family clicking into that. Do you know the full extent of slaveholding? You said Edward Simmons plus maybe 15 other families. I mean, do you feel like you've been able at this point to envision the whole of it?
No, it's interesting. I have found some ancestors here in Massachusetts, in Boston, in Woburn, in Hingham locally, mm-hmm. who were also slave owners. It almost seems the more work that I'm willing to do to look into wills and inventories and vital records, more of these things begin to emerge.
Do relatives want to know about it, or are they like, oh, no, here comes David. He's going to lay some more slave-owning guilt on us?
I think in terms of my family, at this point, I think they're fine with it. There was some initial kind of discomfort about the whole topic because of not being quite clear what will happen as a result of my desire to be public about it. But I think people have learned a lot.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about finding slaves in the family, way north of the Mason-Dixon line. My guest is Reverend David Petit. He opened the books on his own family's history and found slaves and slave trading in the heart of his old New England family. He reached out to the descendants of those slaves, and one of them has been struggling mightily to get to the studio in New York. We should have her in just a few minutes, but let's get a call first from Buffalo, New York. Mary Ellen is calling. Mary Ellen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great program.
Thank you.
I'm a descendant of a man who came to the original Plymouth colony in 1625 with two, we think, slaves with him that he had purchased in the Caribbean on his way to America. And I wouldn't have found out about this because although there was the big trumpeting of the news that we were all descendants of original Mayflower settlers, this was carefully hidden. And the only reason I found out about it was that in 1968, the Plymouth Plantation opened its doors. This is the historical recreation of what the original Plymouth Colony looked like. And the original Abraham Pierce docent that went around there was, he was portrayed as a black man because of a misreading of a tax document.
So is it common knowledge now in your family, Mary Ellen, and how do you all take that on board?
Yes, it is, but it has been dismissed. They're supposedly they weren't really slaves, they were indentured servants, and because I think it's been carefully covered up, you know, we don't really know.
We don't really know, but
he could be the first guy that bought slaves into New England.
A temptation to pretty up the picture, maybe. On the other hand, there it is, and every family wondering, you know, what to make of it as time goes on. Thank you for that. Let's get another call from Williamsville, New York, and Kathy. Kathy, you're on the air. Hello, Kathy, you're on the air.
You already signed out somewhere.
No.
Hello.
Did you sign out?
Yes. Kathy's in the middle of another conversation. I'm sorry for that. David, do you hear Mary Ellen saying, well, I see it here too, and different accounts of what that slavery was like and the severity of it, whether slave is even the right word. Is there any doubt in as far as you can see in your family?
Oh, no. None whatsoever. It's quite evident in terms of census records that people were identified as slaves. No question whatsoever.
Now, again, we're hoping any second now to hear from Patricia Mann, but our time grows short, so tell us about what you learned about the family, Patricia's family, and we hope we have her in a second, how it came on down through the decades during which your family was forgetting about this slavery.
Well, what happened, sort of the short story is that Cuff Simmons was fortunate to marry a woman who inherited some property from her own family, an African-American woman, and Cuff's children held on to that little tiny house in Newport, and it just kept getting passed forward through the generations. Finally left the family as late as 1940. And by virtue of looking at land deeds and other records like that, I was able to kind of track this family forward toward the present and learned that a cluster of them had moved to New York the turn of the last century and then settled in Jamaica, Queens, New York. And to my good fortune, I guess, they had stayed put for the last 80 years.
And for our good fortune, we have one representative of that family with us right now, joining us from New York, Patricia Mann, the eight-greats-granddaughter of Cuff Simmons, who was, in the way of that time, owned by David Petit's family. She's a court stenographer in New York City, runs her own business there, Royal Reporting, Inc., Patricia Mann, thank you very much for laboring to get to the studio. We're glad you're there. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
We've heard the background on David Petit's research, and you've heard just a little bit right there, Patricia, on how he tracked you down in New York. Then came the day when he dialed the phone. It rang at your end. You picked it up. And what did you make of this guy calling you out of the blue with this news?
I didn't know what to make of the phone call at all.
Had you lost track of family history, you know, back to the point that he was focused on? Did you know this history, Patricia?
Well, of course, family history comes in four directions, your mom and your dad and their parents, and it's just one of the four, you know, corners of the compass that I didn't have too much information on, so it was sort of kind of like a gift to find out this information. My mind had just started to wonder over what exactly my grandmother meant when she said that her ancestors can be traced back to the Mayflower. So it was very interesting to find Dave.
And we know from David's side, you know, he made that call with some trepidation. He didn't know, you know, what emotion, what attitude he might run into, whether it would be anger or someone who'd be dismissive of him or something else. What were your feelings when he put this on the table?
Just a little bit skeptical because it came from left field, but other than
what is this, some kind of scam?
Right. Other than that, it was, you know, pretty acceptable.
And
I was glad that he found me.
And as he laid out the research, you and your family took it on board and put it up against the stories that you held in your own memory and your own family tradition. You finally agreed to sort of get together, have the families meet one another. Did that seem like a logical step, a natural step, or weird? Or what did you make of that, Patricia?
Just a tad bit weird because it was someone we didn't know. Other than that, no, it wasn't weird. It was the logical next step.
Let me ask, we know what history is. Are you and David related, other than by the relationship of your once enslaved ancestors? Do you know if you're related? Any idea, Patricia?
I don't know, Dave. Have we answered that question yet?
Well, we may have moved a bit closer to it. There was a television show, African American Lives, Henry Louis Gates on PBS back in February.
Right, and there at was Harvard, where he was tracking down his ancestry through DNA testing to Africa and beyond.
Right. And so I contacted the same company and did some DNA research with them. And just a couple weeks ago, got the results back that, accordingly, I'm about 90% European American, 5% Native American, and about 5% Sub-Saharan African, which was not so much of a surprise given what I've learned. So I think there is indeed a possibility that we are related.
But this is even more complex than we might stereotypically have imagined, because it's you who have that 5%. What about on your side, Patricia? Do you know? Is it clear? Do you have some European ancestry in your line?
Definitely. I'm sure Dave is smiling right now because he came to my house, and I'm pretty fair. My youngest child is blonde and blue-eyed, and my dad was blonde and blue-eyed, so I'm sure that's somewhere in there, yeah.
So just maybe we've got family as well as history shared here. Patricia, how do you think about it? I don't know, if when you get philosophical about it, you know, there's talk about reparations that people have talked about nationally these days. Should those who benefited from this slave labor, you know, be paying something to those who worked that labor, who performed that labor? And then there's this sort of emotional angle to it. Then there's some kind of straight-up philosophical angle. How do you look on this relationship after almost two centuries?
Well, I've done my history just like everyone else, and were those slaves alive, then yes, I would agree with reparations, but history and the past being what it is, the past, we need to make our own way at this point. I mean, we have all the options open to us just like everyone else at this point, so reparations, maybe to those who paid the price with their lives and their family members, but not at this time, not in the present.
David, what about it? How do you? I mean, it sounds overwrought these days to say, how do you live with it? Millions of Americans, in one way or another, are connected to this. On the other hand, it's a big deal. It's a lot just to say, oh yeah, that's history. How do you frame this in your own mind and heart and your families?
To me personally, to be able to share with Pat and her family some of the history and some of the stories I had learned felt to me, along with an apology for my ancestors to Pat, as a kind of personal form of reparations.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think that a national conversation about the legacy of slavery is still needed. I think it remains the elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about. And given the learning of my own particular ancestry now through DNA, the notion, I agree with Pat, that financial reparations to individuals becomes terribly complex, because therefore it would seem, by virtue of my own background, that I would be a beneficiary as well. So it doesn't make any sense.
Well, that's easy for you to say when you're on the owner side.
Well,
of the
ledger. In terms of my own African American
yes,
heritage,
but still, that's five, not 90.
I do think that there clearly are impoverished communities that are under-resourced, and I think it was Frederick Douglass who said it's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. So I, you know, for my own sense of reparations, I think that I would certainly support the funding of education to the most impoverished people in inner cities.
Mm-hmm.
to bring about some of that change and possibility for further growth and transformation.
And how do you hold it emotionally in your mind? I mean, when you're getting together with Patricia's family and you're all out on an outing, are you there in an attitude of guilt? I mean, you can't apologize every time you see somebody. How does it just sit in your mind now?
Well, at this point, the sense of guilt that I once felt seems to have dissipated. Pat and her family have been hospitable and graceful and welcoming to me. And there's a way that she and I and our respective families are kind of building a new way forward. You know, we live some miles apart, so we don't get a chance to spend time together all the time. But to me, the conversation is more about how do we create a new legacy of acknowledgement and healing and hope and connection.
Pat, you're a mother of four children aged 8 to 23. How do they look at this guy and his apparently white family that come to the doorstep with this history? Are they interested, dismissive? What's their attitude?
Well, my 8-year-old was very happy to meet Dave and his family. As a matter of fact, she got in his car and left us and went off with his two daughters. And that was it. We were like, your daughter, she's gone and she's in the other car now. But that, I guess you can chalk up to her innocence. My oldest two really don't know what to make of it. They really, I guess they haven't come to terms with any of it. They haven't seen or experienced or felt some of the history that I've gone through in my years on the planet. My younger son actually came with us, and we all had a pretty good time. Yeah. We met in Newport News, and we toured the old homesteads, and we went actually to the port. We had lunch. It was wonderful.
Imagine if those ancestors could somehow have looked into a magic ball here and looked ahead. Let's take a call from Newton, Massachusetts, and Lee. Hi, Lee. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling to get a few historical facts into the record that I think weren't brought out yet. The New England states eliminated slaveholding soon after the Revolution. So I heard a woman say that slaveholding was, that it was going on all along, but it really stopped by the 1780s. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, one of the states, I think, had eliminated slaveholding before the Revolution. And also that the southern states made a distinction between slave trading with Africa and slave owning. And there was some time before the Civil War that the southern states, I'm not sure, 1830s maybe, that they eliminated, importing slaves from Africa. So they bred their own slaves. They did not import them after a while. The West Indies were run by England, or at least some of the West Indies countries were run by England, and they continued trading with West Africa for longer until Great Britain eliminated slave owning, which was before our revolution, but I'm really not sure the date of that. I only know this. My father-in-law is a professional historian who specializes in slavery issues, and so I asked him about this a while back, and I just know what I learned from looking over his shoulder.
It's good to have the record right there. I mean, these were active conversations. New England, of course, ultimately became a powerful center of the abolitionist movement, but doors were shutting on slavery along the way. David, what do you know about how and when your family got out of the hair of Patricia's family, got out of the slavery business and slaveholding itself?
It would have been between the time of the 1800 census and 1803 when Edward Simmons died. And it's clear after that point in the records that begin to emerge that after 1803, Cuff Simmons is a free man. And to the best of my knowledge, that was the last enslaved African that my family had any contact with.
And Patricia, what about the knowledge of those slave years in your family? I mean, until that call came from David, did you had the historical memory stayed of what part of the country your family had come to, of what kind of circumstances they had labored?
Well, that is so far removed from my immediate family. The information that Dave gave me was basically the first in-depth information that I had ever gotten from my paternal grandmother's side of the family. So up until the point where Dave and I made contact, I had very little information on my father's side of the family and his mother's heritage.
You had a famous forebear in Sarah Harris in Connecticut, which you've learned about together here.
Exactly.
David was ultimately a kind of confidant of Frederick Douglass.
Well, more so than that, in the 1830s, a Quaker woman by the name of Prudence Crandall in Canterbury, Connecticut, opened a school for girls. And Sarah Harris, who lived in Canterbury, approached her, a young 19-year-old African-American woman, mm-hmm. and said, I want to study too.
Mm-hmm.
And Prudence, given her Quaker sensibilities, said, okay. And this set off an enormous storm of reactivity to the point that the school was closed because she couldn't protect the safety of the students. And it radicalized Sarah Harris, whom is one of Pat's great-great-great-great-great-grandmothers. And she became a confidant of Frederick Douglass, active in the New England abolitionist movement. And at the University of Rhode Island in Kingston, they've named a dormitory after her.
History is just unbelievably complex, tragic in corners, and then inspiring in others. We hear it right there. It's kind of overwhelming, the graciousness that you all have found looking back on this history together. And we're really grateful to both of you for sharing what you've learned and your perspectives. Patricia Mann, thank you so much for getting into that studio. We're really glad you're there in New York today. Thank you so much for joining us, Ms. Mann. And David Petit, thanks for digging into that family history and then sharing it with us. Fascinating story. Thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Reverend David Petit, Unitarian Universalist ordained minister who looked into his own family's history. You can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.